Continental Podcast, episode 85.
Greetings and welcome to the Comics Coffee Metal Podcast. I'm your host, Don Cardenas, and I hope you've been having a fantastic week. Well, folks, it happened. I ran out of time. I did not get a chance to delve deep enough into any comics, coffee, or metal to offer up some recommendations this week. I apologize, but I think it kind of fits the theme for this week with my guest. And, well, you'll get to that when we start the interview, but yeah, I have a fantastic interview lined up with James Lawrence, and he's an awesome dude. It was a super long, super awesome conversation. He and I could have chatted for much longer, and he has an awesome, awesome Kickstarter launching today as of posting July 1st for the next volume of his Legend of La Mariposa wrestling comic, and it is a ton of fun. It looks super great. And I highly recommend you go check that out. Back it, give him like a super great first day, and then come back here, listen to the interview, because it's going to be just make it a day. Make it a James Lawrence day. Yeah. All right.
Oh, hello, fellow humans. You caught me in the middle of drinking coffee while reading comics and listening to metal. Do you ever get curious about how your favorite creators get their inspiration? Have you ever wondered what led them down this path? Well, join me, noted comic book heartthrob Grant Stoy, as I do deep dive interviews with some of the best comic book folks around on Into the Comics Cave. Each week we examine a creator's history and find out stuff like where they grew up or whether or not birds with lips are sexy. You can find us on Apple, Stitchers, most anywhere you stream your podcast. Now back to my favorite hugger in the world, Don Cardenas.
And it is now time for my guest. Now, it's no secret to anyone who listens to the show or knows me at all that I can be a bit of a mess when it comes to getting to things or wanting to do things and not getting to them. And this interview is one of those things. My awesome guest, James Lawrence, contacted me over a year ago. And while for all intents and purposes, I'm like, yes, let's do this. Your book looks awesome. You know, you seem like a really cool guy. Let's do this. The timing didn't work out and things slipped through my fingers. But thankfully, you know, James and I, you know, we've had our interactions through Twitter and stuff like that. And time came and I'm like, you know what? I just realized this. It's been a year. James, can you come back on? And thankfully James was like, yes, sir, let's do this. So with that aside, I can't wait to talk to James about Comics Coffee and Metal, his awesome, awesome comic, The Legend of La Mariposa, and just all the fun stuff that comes with that. But as we go, I always have to ask James Lawrence, Comics Coffee Metal, what are you digging right now?
Oh man, I've been on like a tear with all three recently.
That's
first of
life.
All, thanks for having me. Thanks for having me. It's like I love the show. I'm really pleased to be on. But yeah, I'm just gonna go straight in because I've got a few things.
Dive right in. Let's get to it.
Yeah, man. So comics wise, I've been reading like a pile of stuff recently. I've been all over the map with it. So I just finished the other day this book by Jeremy Cerise called The Short While, which is this like this fat graphic novel. It's kind of like a little bit non-standard because it's got like large sections of kind of prose text in it, but then it's got sort of sequences of kind of comic as well.
Okay.
It's really, really good. It's kind of like two guys meeting, getting into a relationship and then breaking up and kind of like processing that, but it's all against the backdrop of this kind of this post-internet, post-cyberpunk kind of future, where like the States is just emerging from like a fairly disastrous authoritarian regime.
That's not prescient.
Cool. No, not at all. I mean, it's interesting because it takes some twists and turns in that regard that you wouldn't immediately expect.
Okay.
And it's like, it's that kind of like, I don't know if there's like a sci-fi term for it, but it's that kind of magical realism I really like. where there's like there's robots and flying cars and stuff in the background, but the story's really about these characters processing their trauma and their relationship and stuff like that. So the, you know, the world building and kind of the setting is secondary to the actual plot.
Awesome. That sounds awesome.
On the other side of that, I'm finally starting to read Berserk. Like maybe like 20 years ahead of everyone else.
You know what? You beat me to it. It is definitely something I'm trying to find the first volume to start, and because so many people I know and respect just love the book, and I'm like, I can definitely learn something from this book. I can definitely get some enjoyment out of this. Let me look for it. Let me get the physical copy, and I just can't. So I'm gonna have to figure out a digital way to get it. I haven't really looked that far into it digitally to see how available it is.
I mean, I've been reading mine through like just like Comixology.
Okay.
In spite of like the recent kind of like assassination of Comixology, I've still been like picking up the odd book on there. So it is available for like fairly reasonable prices.
Okay.
So I've just been like devouring it. It is like, I didn't actually realize, I knew it was a really dark series. I don't think I realized how dark it is. Mm-hmm. So like I was initially reading it at like work, like between meetings or in the morning when I was kind of like getting my head together to like actually start the work day, and then there are certain sequences that I was just like, I can't read this here. I have to read this like in like with my back to a wall with a blanket over my head so no one can like look over my shoulder. Because it's rough, man. It's rough in places.
Yeah, it's to kind of tie it into metal a little bit. There is a band called Beast in Black that are heavily inspired by Berserk.
Nice.
That I think you know, if you like a little electronic synth stuff in your metal,
yeah,
definitely check them out. I enjoy them a lot. I had only just found out that like because they just released a video that was Berserk inspired. That had you know some of the like an animated. I don't know if they're using animation from the show or from a movie or if it was generated for this music video, but it was, you know, Berserk inspired. And I was talking to buddy and former guest Lan Pitts just this week, and he's like, "Oh no, they're like completely all Berserk inspired." Like, "Oh, I didn't pick up on that because I didn't read the book or whatever." So, yeah, that's definitely something to check out.
Oh hell yeah! I really like, Lan's like a solid dude, so like I'll take his recommendation.
Yeah,
he actually was kind enough to provide a cover for the back of the new book.
Oh, nice. Yeah, because he's a big wrestling guy, so yeah. But we'll get to the book soon enough, sir. So
yeah, no problem.
Yeah,
right, so I've been going between like heartfelt kind of like you know kind of queer relationship drama. So, like, I guess a different kind of queer relationship drama because, like, you know, Berserk has the, without giving anything away, Berserk has the whole sort of, like, relationship between Guts and Griffith. I mean, there are, like, you know, insane demons and, like, a lot of violence, but it's a deceptively emotional story, like, at its core.
Awesome, awesome. Yet, you know, it's, I think that kind of switch between content or like the intensity of content, it's not that jarring as it used to be, I think, when people talk about it, just because we have access to everything now, so it kind of makes sense. Like, you know, give it, you know, comics or TV shows or music or whatever, like I could easily be listening to something that's heavy and intense and then switch to something that's light and poppy, like, you know, and just, you know, kind of float between those because, you know, we're humans. We have our own ebbs and flows in our days and our emotions and all that. So I don't think it's too much of a stretch to see that you've got that going on, especially with comic book reading, because, you know, comics like metal are, you know, the best version of a particular medium. So
yeah, I agree.
Awesome. Awesome. So, coffee. What's your coffee routine like? What's your favorites? What do you go to for that?
So I'm a cafetiere guy, like like a French press. Mm-hmm. I just really like kind of the body that it gives coffee, and like, you know, it's quite satisfying to like put the plunger down and everything like that. You just have this big old jar of kind of coffee that you keep refilling into your cup. I'm not like a huge kind of coffee dweeb or anything. I take it black and I kind of drink what's on offer. I am at the stage now where I have to like hit the hard stuff for it to actually work properly. there's this thing that there's this way of doing it called the long black, which is basically like an espresso but more. Which is the only thing I can like if I need the coffee to wake me up, that's the thing I have to go to now. But then like the day to day sipping is just like in the cafetiere. Like the weird thing that I've been drinking recently is one of my students, because I'm a lecturer in my day job, one of my students, as a thank you gift for like getting them to like graduation, they bought me some of that Malaysian coffee that's been filtered through like a weasel. Do you know that stuff?
Oh, what is it? It's they eat the berries, digest it, and then that's the only way like that the berries can be like harvested.
Yeah, exactly. Into the beans. So like it's called a palm civet.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And, like a civet is like it looks like a raccoon and a weasel possum thing. Had a baby.
Yeah.
You know, they allegedly pick the best cherries, and then pass the actual bean through their system, and then like apparently that does something to the bean and enhances the flavor. So these poor people have to follow these weasels around and, like pick coffee beans out of their crap. So they bought me a really nice presentation box in the bag of that, and I just polished that off.
Is it worth the hype?
It's coffee. It's like I couldn't really taste like any kind of like real difference. If anything, the coffee was kind of thin. Maybe that's because the bag was like, or it came pre-ground, and it was very finely ground.
Okay.
But I wasn't just like, oh, I can really taste the ferret. You know, like
that's quite a slogan. Taste the ferret. Oh boy. You mentioned something about, you know, having to hit the hardest stuff for it to do its job. And that got me thinking, like, cause I drink roughly, half a pot of coffee a day. And some days more, some days that's usually the low end is half a pot. I think I've definitely reached a point to where, I don't know. I don't think I'm drinking coffee for the caffeine intake. I'm just drinking it because I like it. And, you know, I take mine with a little cream and sugar. So, you know, naturally, there's that extra fact to bring in with in terms of like drinkability and enjoyment. Because when I have tried just drinking black coffee and stuff like that, usually after like one cup, I'm like, okay, I can take a break for a while from this. But, so yeah, I guess I'm trying to think like what level of caffeine would I need to just like make it do its job. And I'm kind of scared to try some of these more like high intensity caffeinated ones, like the Death Wish coffee and
I mean those give me the ick anyway, because the marketing is just so like I don't know, it's kind of cringy in a way. It's like kind of very on the nose.
Yeah
Like you know, just death before decaf, crack skull coffee, and it's like, come on, man. I just woke up.
Yeah. I just need something to make me not fall asleep right now. Like, I don't need, like, you know, something that's borderline illegal.
There's this brand of coffee shops in the UK called Black Sheep Coffee. And they get this, like, I don't think it's specific to them. I think it's like a place to get anywhere, but it's a type of coffee bean called the Robusta bean.
Okay.
And that thing has like something ridiculous, like four times the amount of caffeine that like your typical kind of Arabica coffee bean does.
All right.
And so like I've had like a black coffee with the Robusta beans before, and that kind of keeps you going for like a good like half a day with just one small cup of it. So for a while, that was my like, okay, I really need to focus up, but I've not like really slept. Yeah. So I'm going to nip down to Black Sheep. I'm going to have one of these cups of like Robusta, and I'm just going to basically, it's like trucker speed. Like you need to like have something then to kind of like bring you down to a sensible level so you can actually do your job without like vibrating through the walls.
Yeah, it's funny you mentioned the term trucker speed because I wanted to bring that up when I was talking about the high caffeine stuff. I'm like, is that a reference that works for you? Like, cause I know like obviously trucking is all around the world, but I'm like, is that specific reference a US thing or...
I mean, I know it's always tricky for me because like I'm so immersed in US culture and I have been like my whole life. So like I will drop references and I will think it's like a killer joke. And then people are just like, what the hell are you talking about? Because it's like an American reference. I can't even remember what it was that I did. Like, because I made the joke in front of like a bunch of my students and it just died. It just died. And I was just like, I was like, and you know, my reaction when a joke dies is just to kind of be like, you know what, screw you, that was funny. And then someone's just like, that's just an American reference, mate, no one gets it. I was like, oh no.
Like, you're students, you're young, you should be more in tune with this than you are.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know why I kind of like absorbed, because like I know the you know, the Sanka brand that you mentioned for the Patreon exclusive episode, so I know Sanka. And like, you know, so like just weird, like obscure stuff, but why would I know it? Like, you know, stuff like Folgers, coffee crystals, and that kind of thing.
Oh, that's funny. I would definitely be that teacher who just makes, you know, not even just obscure references, expecting people to have have the same knowledge base I do of like stupid things. You have extensive knowledge of stupid things, but that's just my own description of my own knowledge. It's just a collection of stupid things.
Oh, yeah, I have my own reference points. I don't give students a hard time for like not having absorbed the same stuff that I absorbed because it's like different priorities from generation to generation. I used to get really mad when students hadn't seen Akira.
Okay.
I still think it's something that people should watch. I used to get annoyed. I'd be like, you haven't seen Akira. What's wrong with you? And then I was just like, why would they have seen Akira? Because they were all born like, you know, that film was like, when did that film come out?
88?
Yeah, so I was 4 years old when that film was released. And like, you know, a lot of my students, that film was released like 16 years, like 12 years before they were born.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, of course they haven't seen it. So, you know, I just kind of recommend it to them. So like, it's kind of an old film. Still holds up. Give it a watch. I think you'll like it.
It kind of reminds me of like Watchmen. And people would tell me like, you got to read Watchmen. You got to read Watchmen. And I'm like, okay. But the problem is, like, as much as I can acknowledge Watchmen of being, you know, a well-crafted book, you know, a mastercraft of comics, I experienced comics in the wake of it.
Yeah.
So all these things, like all these tropes or all these things are like kind of like railing against or kind of saying like, this is, you know, not good. Like, that's all the stuff that I'm like, oh yeah, that's how comics. That's the cool stuff of comics because that's what was prevalent. That was the taste of things. So, I guess enjoying the thing that's being kind of not necessarily mocked because I don't think you know Watchmen was full. You know, I don't think Alan Moore and Dave Gibbons knew that the '90s were going to be the way they were. but you know, being able to like say like, oh man, they're calling that like that. I'm coming in after the fact, so. Definitely, I could see where your students come from with that. Though, you know, for me, my enjoyment of Watchmen was probably severely tainted because of the the hype of it. I couldn't just sit down and enjoy it.
It's held like such a sacred object that it kind of has a weight to like reading it, and then it, all of a sudden it goes from being a good book that you should read and will enjoy to being like some sort of academic text.
Yes. Yes. There you go.
Yeah. No, I get that. Like I'm just saying, cause I haven't seen the Godfather films.
Mm-hmm.
Not because I don't want to, it's just like, I just never got around to it and everyone else has already apparently seen them. But like, people get upset with you when you tell them you haven't seen The Godfather. and it's just like, well, you know, I've seen so many other like mob movies that are like post Godfather. I've seen so many mafia movies and I've seen it referenced so often. I'm sure it's a great film, but like, is it a great film because it's like the progenitor for like all these other films that I've seen as a consequence, or does it stand alone, you know, in its own right? And also the fact that whenever I do want to watch it, no one wants to watch it with me.
Yeah.
Like, so I've like, on more than one occasion, someone's been like, you haven't seen The Godfather, what's wrong with you? It's like, well, you've got the DVD on your shelf over there, let's watch it right now. And they're just like, oh, no, I'm not in the mood. It's like, well, how entertaining, how good could it really be if you don't want to watch it? Because there are films that if someone's not seen it before, I will be like, oh, do you want to watch it like right now? Because I can watch that film whenever, mm-hmm. you know? And that for me is possibly the indicator of like a great film.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, it's just like, it could be like any time of the day, any time of the year. And you're just like, yeah, I'm down to watch that film right now.
You mentioned like the, you know, is The Godfather great because it's this progenitor of these other mafia films. And I was someone who I've seen parts of The Godfather my entire life. Yeah. I've not seen them. I had not seen them in whole until a few years ago. And even then, you know, I got it, like what it was supposed to be. But like in my generation, like Goodfellas was the mafia movie, you know?
Oh yeah.
And, but I, this is a bit of going a little bit off topic here, but I had actually seen this movie called My Blue Heaven first.
Right.
I don't know if you've seen this movie with Steve Martin and Rick Moranis.
No, I haven't. I've heard the title. I know of it.
Okay. Well, it's about, you know, Steve Martin plays a mafia guy who's in witness protection, and Rick Moranis is the FBI agent who's tasked with like keeping him on the straight and narrow before the trial and all that. And the funny thing is that movie stemmed from the writer-director of that movie was married to the guy who was writing the book about Henry Hill, who is the movie Goodfellas is based on. So basically, she was privy to all this. So you got My Blue Heaven and Goodfellas off of the same launching point. And it's these two entirely different but great movies. that's just kind of where my mind was going when you're talking about that. But I did see the Godfather movies a few years ago. They were playing on Google. They had like a whole marathon of them, and I was hanging a drop ceiling in my basement, and I had the TV down there, and it was on. I'm like, oh, I'll put this on. So I was kind of like passively watching it while I was doing stuff, and I'm like, okay, I get it. I get why this is good and all that. But yeah, there's no like huge reverence of it for me. And, you know, like you said, there's plenty of people I've met who are like, oh, Scarface is an amazing movie. It's like, okay, let's watch it. Like, oh, I shit you not. There's like three or four times someone has told me that. And I'm like, all right, well, can I borrow it? Can I watch it? Like, oh, I don't have it. I don't own it. Like, what fucking good movie is it then?
Exactly. Like,
it's, you know, it's like someone's like, oh man, I've never seen Hot Fuzz. I'm like, here, take my copy. I'll go buy another one. Like, go. Like,
I love that you put Hot Fuzz in the same like tier as like The Godfather. And,
I
like,
think it
Starface.
Deserves it. I think it deserves it.
I think it's possibly the most perfect comedy movie.
It is. It
Hot
is.
Fuzz.
I mean, I prefer a zombie movie to a buddy cop movie, but I think between Sean and Hot Fuzz is just, everyone is just at their peak, I think.
Yeah, I'm always curious because like Hot Fuzz is like, it's obviously riffing off like the classic kind of, you know, it's riffing off Bad Boys, it's riffing off Lethal Weapon, the buddy cop action movie kind of thing, but like it's intensely English in like a lot of the humor. I've always wondered about how that comes across to like people who aren't English.
Well, I think it's kind of the reverse. Like, I've I can't say I'm a, you know, I don't know what the proper term would be, but I don't think I'm not hugely versed in English culture, but I've had access to enough to know, you know, to get the jokes on a lot of the things. And sometimes, you know, watching it multiple times, you kind of like through context, I think you get what's going on. I think that's part of the genius of that movie, is that through context, you get even a joke you might not normally have gotten, you get it because it's just well crafted and well done and all that. Now, I can't speak as highly as Edgar Wright's later works. They have not struck a chord with me, but Hot Fuzz is definitely like in my top five for sure.
Yeah, I mean, Hot Fuzz is like, it's just so, like you say, everyone in it is just acting like they're their absolute peak, and the jokes still hit. I think I've seen that film like 20 times.
Yeah.
And the jokes still hit, and like, you know, it's insanely kind of like quotable, which I think is often really important for kind of like a film like that.
The amount of times I say to myself, "Narp," like just, you know, just everything about that movie is just so well done. So well done.
I mean, one of my favorite lines of all time is like, if you want to be a big copper in a small town, F off up the model village. Like, that's just the way that's delivered is just so on point. And like, I think Paddy Considine's character, like one of the Andes, is like my favorite character in that film. And it's especially so funny when you know what like Paddy Considine's like film output is like as a director, because he makes like the darkest, bleakest films, but he's also just like an insanely like clever like comedy actor.
Yeah, the Andes are definitely like one of those just pristine things in that movie. That's just like every time they're on, it's just like you just feel like the movie's just on it's operating on just a different level than other kind of comedies and stuff like that. Just because everyone is so distinct and unique, but also they fit in that world so perfectly.
I mean, yes, absolutely. So just the other bit is just kind of like talking in terms of like the references you can make. I don't think I've ever had someone like drink like a latte or like a nice frothy beer, and then like, you know, I say to them, "Oh, you've got a mustache," and they just go, they've never not gone, "I know."
Nice.
Hey there, I'm Liana Kangas, and I'm actually the co-host of Comics Inebriated, a podcast about current and past events for history and weird facts about comics, pop culture. And all the while, we actually sit down with our fun special guests and have a quick drink. And one of those guests is actually Don of this very podcast. So come over, come hang out, come listen to it, and enjoy your time for the rest of this podcast.
We've strayed a little bit, but I'm sure you have plenty to talk about on our next topic, and that is metal. What is the metal that is driving you lately? What's bumping in the James Lawrence jukebox?
I will be like honest. I'm like a shallow little dilettante when it comes to metal. I don't really dig deep into like the deep old hits. Like I have like a fairly sort of solid metal rotation. Like I'm big, like one of my favorite bands of all time is Judas Priest. I've already mentioned them, like in kind of the Patreon episode. So like I'm a huge Judas Priest fan. Because like what's not to like? It's just got like insane riffs, and all the songs are either about being horny, wearing leather, or like evil robots. You know, so it's like it's crazy good. I kind of like anything that's kind of got like a bit of driving speed to it.
Okay.
So like I go kind of like all over the map. So like I've been listening to a lot of Judas Priest. I've been listening to a lot of Power Trip. My friend Mark Penman, who's like another really talented comic artist, got me into Power Trip. So like there's not kind of like a week that goes by where I don't listen to like Executioner's Tax like at least once. I've been on a huge Killswitch Engage like, Bender recently. Because, like, I was, all my musical taste is, like, firmly grounded in what I was listening to at university, like, circa 2005. You know?
Yeah,
it's... And I found the Killswitch Engage is really good to work out to, because it's just so earnest.
Yeah.
And that kind of helps me along. And the other big thing as well is, do you know Zeelanada?
Yes, yes. I heard that name so long, and their most recent album is with the time I did, like, okay, let me check this out. And it is so, like, heavy, but so unique and so not heavy at times. Yeah, it's fantastic stuff.
Yeah, I love Zeelanada. Like, that kind of, because I'm kind of like a milquetoast, so, like, a lot of black metal just, like, leaves me cold.
Mm-hmm.
Because just, and it's proper just like, oh, I can't hear what they're saying. and like, you know, and then Zeelanada kind of hits that exact balance, because it mixes that, like, sort of insane sort of, like, where it's just like a rush of sound, and then you have, like, a little bit of a, like a come down, like, with kind of, like, the more melodic aspects of it.
Okay.
Yeah, so I'm all about it.
There's two bands I'd like to recommend to you then, based on what you've told me that I think you would dig. They're more modern bands, so it's a more modern style of metal that they're doing. But there's a band called Rollo Tomasi, R-O-L-O. Okay, they are excellent. They are very much in the Zeal and Ardor vein of just having a lot of just space and things, and just not afraid to be, just have things be different, but it's still, like, you know, still a big vibe. It's still heavy and moody, but sometimes it's very delicate.
Cool. All right, I have heard the name, so I need to give them a look.
And another one is Spirit Box.
Spirit Box.
They are definitely more in the metal-y vein, but their female vocalist, she can do, like, she like alternates between these, like, beautiful, delicate vocals, and just, she has a, you know, one of the best growls going today. Nice. So, and they really, like, float in between, like, songs that are just deeply emotional, deeply not heavy at all, but heavy in, like, mood and lyric wise. And then they just got stuff that's just got huge, fat, killer riffs. And so I would definitely check them out, because those are two bands I'm probably the most two of the bands I'm most excited about hearing stuff from. Because Spirit Box actually just released a new single yesterday called Rotoscope, and it is so different from some stuff they've been doing, but it still fits with them because they're also not afraid to just do something a little different. It's almost like what someone called, like, dance metalcore or something like that. It's crazy, but it's really good. And I would, you know, if you get a chance to check them out, I'd love to hear your thoughts, whether you liked them or didn't, because
I've been taking notes of, like, all the music that you kind of, like, talked about so far. So I'm gonna have to come back at you with some comments on that. Like,
awesome.
I love, like, I love, like, a female fronted band.
Yeah.
Just because of the different range of vocals that you get. Mm-hmm. Like, do you know Blood Command?
Blood Command? No, I...
Blood Command. They're a sweet... They describe themselves as death pop, but it's kind of like very kind of metalcore-y kind of thing. They're a Swedish band. They have the EP that I'd recommend, an EP called Return of the Arsonist. And, like, that's really good because it's just driving kind of, like, power kind of punk metalcore thing with some really strong kind of, like, brash vocals from the lead singer. And it's like, yeah, just good stuff.
Oh, okay.
Good stuff. They got a new vocalist recently that I'm still waiting to be brought around to. It's kind of like a different, doesn't quite have the flourish of the old vocalist.
Mm-hmm.
Because the old vocalist would kind of, like, you know, inject a lot of themselves into it. I think the new one's still kind of finding her feet.
Okay.
But, like, the entire, so they've been going since, like, 2003. But, like, their most recent kind of output, it's pretty great. It's kind of in the same vein as, like, Cavell Attack.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm definitely familiar with them. So yeah, that just ratcheted them up on the checkout list a few notches. Well, to throw one more back at you then, this band is very much a straightforward kind of death metal band, but it is entirely female members.
All right.
And their name is Crypta.
Crypta.
Yeah.
Is that with a K or?
You know, it's a C, just Crypt with A. That's how it's spelled.
Crypta.
And they, I enjoy all the kinds of metal, but you know, traditional death metal is something that's, you know, hit and miss for me because of the vocals and all that. But
sure,
you know, this band, they just, I don't know, they got their hooks in me. So I think they're like an excellent gateway band for someone who's probably, you know, interested in checking out more death metal stuff, just because. The vocals perfectly fit with death metal. You know, it's that, you know, growly, higher kind of snarl. But I think coming from a female voice, it seems more approachable.
Right.
Cool. Than, you know, imagining a guy with long hair, you know, going real high into the microphone and screeching. It's like, you kind of like get that kind of almost silly idea off your head, where it's like, no, this comes across as more aggressive and this like almost theatrical. So yeah, definitely. All right. I'd say definitely check them out. And yeah for sure.
Oh yeah, cool.
So is do you listen primarily to music when you're creating your comics, or do you kind of, let's say, waffle between things you do, or do you work in silence?
I can't work in silence.
Okay.
I only really work in silence when I'm thumbnailing.
Okay.
Or when I'm writing, and that is a slog. I need a little. I like a little background music to keep the energy levels up.
Okay.
To be honest, I don't listen to music that often unless there's like a new album that I'm like obsessed with, because otherwise I find myself just spending more time tweaking playlists and like finding new things to listen to.
Okay.
Than I do actually working on stuff.
Okay.
If I need to sit down and just put in some like hours at the board,
yeah,
I usually go to like an audiobook.
Oh, okay.
Or like a podcast series. If I need to be hyped for like an action scene, then I put the music on.
Okay.
And it's usually something that I have like listened to a bunch before and I'm really familiar with.
Mm-hmm.
So I can get a sense of the ebbs and flows. If I listen to like too much new stuff while I'm meant to be concentrating on work, I get like distracted. I'm just like, oh, this new band's awesome. Who are these people again? Where are they from?
Yeah,
do they have
yeah.
any merch? Are they touring soon? And yeah. before I know, I'm just like on my laptop, like tippy-tapping away while my page goes undrawn.
100%. I find that for me, when I'm, you know, I haven't written a ton, but when I'm writing, I find music to be kind of distracting, not in the same way that it's like, oh, I can't, like, even if lyrics, no lyric, whatever it is, but I can, but I still need something. And I find I can actually write to like podcasts or videos or things, YouTube videos, something like that. For some reason that can just be reduced to like a white noise in the back of my head. And then I can write. But when I'm drawing, you know, I'm finding the opposite, the videos and stuff, they get too distracting. And I need the music. So, but I find it funny for myself that when I'm drawing like an action scene or something that's probably more horror thing themed or graphic or whatever, I'm listening to like synth pop. You know, I'm listening to like totally not deep dark metal. And when I'm doing stuff that requires like emotive faces and talking heads and stuff like that, for some reason I drift back to the metal for that. So I'm drawing people having a serious conversation, and you know, I'm listening to, you know, some like deathcore going on, and then I'm drawing people getting eviscerated, you know, and I'm like bopping to, you know, the latest Paramore or whatever. So
I think it's weird how that happens, because I'm kind of the same way. Like, the thing I joke about is The content of my comics does not reflect what I kind of like absorb while I'm making them.
Yes, yes.
Because, like, you know, I will be drawing my all ages kind of like, you know, slapstick adventure. And then what I'm listening to is like, it's like a true crime podcast, which just goes into excruciating detail about how people were murdered. Or like, I'm listening to like a really kind of like dark, like audiobook, that kind of just does not like hold back at all with the details. So like, it's one of those things, it's like, there's like a meme kicking around that I have saved on my computer that I think encapsulates it perfectly. It's just like, it's this gnarly looking werewolf maquette, and next to it is a golden retriever.
Oh yes, I've identified with that for many, many things.
Yeah, yes, and I basically described that because that's kind of like what I make and what I listen to while I'm making it.
Yeah,
as well, because it's just like,
yeah, I think mine was like
weirdly
me
helps.
Yeah, mine was definitely the me what I listen to.
Yeah, exactly.
I knew exactly what you're talking about. Yeah, it's, you know, I can't explain it, and it's not, you know, it's not like a 100% for sure every single time, but it is the majority of the time. That's how it kind of shakes out for me. But yeah, as you mentioned, you know, you draw in all ages slapstick book, and it is from what I've read, it is a hilarious, awesome book, and you have an upcoming Kickstarter for that. So let's get into that. The Legend of La Mariposa. What were the beginnings of this book? Where did this idea come from to do this, and how long have you been doing it?
Sorry, dude. Actually, just before we get started, are we right to just pause recording just one quick second?
Sure, sure.
Yeah, I just, I thought my battery was going to hold out, and it's not, so I've got to go and wake my dog up to get my power supply.
Oh, you know what? Okay. It's fine.
All right, sorry, bud. I'll be right
back. No worries.
Hey, I'm back. Sorry about that.
No problem at all.
Yeah, it's just I thought, because it had a full charge.
Yeah.
And I've just been watching the number just tick down. So over the course of this recording, it's gone from like 100% down to 23%. I was like, oh, it's not going to hold out.
No problem. I appreciate you making the effort to get that recorded for safety's sake.
Yeah, no worries.
All right. Well, let me think. Where were we? I didn't hit pause on the recording just because it's easier just to edit it out than like stop it, start a new recording, and blah blah blah. So,
yeah, I kind of assumed. I just left mine running as well.
Okay.
Cool. So, the Legend of La Mariposa.
All right. So, let me see. Let me think of a good way to cut this in. Actually, you know what? Yeah, if you just want to pick up with, you know, starting to talk about it, that should be able to fit into me asking about it. So,
yeah, cool.
All right.
So the Legend of La Mariposa is an all ages fantasy adventure series that's kind of inspired by the kind of tropes and traditions of lucha libre, also known as Mexican wrestling. The general idea was to kind of like combine, you know, basically apply full kayfabe to a fantasy setting, because the stuff about wrestling that always fascinated me was kind of the pageantry of it and like the suspension of disbelief in the performance, and the fact that you can inject so much kind of like narrative weight into kind of like a simple motion within a wrestling ring, And I, you know, I read a lot of like wrestling related comics, and I like a lot of them. A lot of them tend to be very kind of focused on, replicating the story that you get on like wrestling shows. So, you know, a rookie wrestler rising through the ranks of like a fictional promotion kind of thing, kind of like a fantasy booking scenario. And what I wanted to do is I wanted to sort of see, can I take the kind of like the sort of the culture and the sort of the I guess the superstitions and traditions of wrestling and then kind of apply it wholesale to a fantasy setting. The end result was kind of something that I described as being Conan the Barbarian, but with shining wizards instead of swords. Because the general idea was kind of like doing sort of pulpy genre fiction stories about like a wandering, it could be a samurai movie, it could be a Wild West movie. You know, taking that kind of like story format and then filtering it through Lucha Libre. Like, yeah. Can I have this character come in and get embroiled in these adventures and then kind of like exit the story? And then move on to like the next self-contained adventure, kind of like fairly seamlessly. That was the goal.
Okay. Yeah, and Lucha Libre is, I mean, just in and of itself, it lends itself to these gigantic, fantastical kinds of stories. Because even within Mexican culture itself, there's series of movies about Lucha Libre and just the crazy spy adventures and just all these different genres they kind of cross over with. So. Yeah, that was definitely a good idea to like just like, okay, this is something that works, can work in these crazier settings. And it's been a blast seeing, you know, some of the stuff, because you sent me a PDF of one of the collections, and I was just looking it over again today, and I was still chuckling at some of the references and things you toss in there and all that. And I think you kind of like nail what you described. You really got that vibe going with it, and it was super entertaining. Now,
thank you. You've
been just rocking on this book. You've got multiple collections now, and what's this upcoming Kickstarter? What number collection is this?
So this is going to be volume 3. This is going to be like the third. So like it's been a bit weird because I like started with like the big opus first, and then since then the books have been gradually declining in size. I've kind of done a reverse Harry Potter. And that's actually kind of like deliberate, because basically over the course of like doing the Demon Gauntlet and doing kind of the stories that have become The Climb and other stories, I kind of hit upon like what I feel is like the best format for the Legend of La Mariposa. I've hit like the optimum length for the stories now, which is what Bolton's challenge is. It's kind of like, it feels like La Mariposa in its kind of perfect form at the moment, because it's not like a mini anthology, which is, you know, that's the second book. It's not like a long kind of like opus, which is kind of like me not following my own advice of going for like the big adventure first. The third one is kind of like what La Mariposa I wanted it to be kind of all along, which is kind of like, it's like a 54 page story. The book itself is like 60 pages in total. The actual story itself, I think, is about 54 pages, and it just feels like the right kind of length. It's enough that it's kind of like, you got like a nice kind of chunky book, but
yeah,
it's
definitely
not like huge, but it's like, it's more digestible, you know. Yeah. It's more affordable. It's more kind of like, you could read it in the course of like a car trip.
Yeah, it's not a huge daunting thing. So like, oh man, I want to read this, but man, this is going to take me like a long time. So I need to set aside this time to do. It's like, no, it's a good length where it's like, all right, I could read this fast, and I can go back and I can really dive into it and kind of absorb it slowly. That length you kind of mentioned, I think between like 50 to like 100 pages for collections and stuff like that, to me, are kind of like the sweet spot. even and I realize I literally said like 50 and 100, which is like double 50. So, but it, in the grand scheme of things, like, you know, past that, you know, I think was it 100 pages now would be what, 5 20 page comics. So, and that's kind of what collections are, trades are now anyway. But I think for one complete story, I think that's a great length. And I'm glad that you kind of found your sweet spot with that, because now you kind of now you have like your, you know, it's one of those things where you're doing something for a while and you kind of like, not necessarily have the formula for it, but you're like, okay, like this feels right. So now when you're doing things, like you can use that as a gauge to the things you're doing.
Oh yeah, totally. Yeah, because I'm actually working on volume 4 at the moment. That's clocking in at like 40 plus pages, and then I've got a couple of backups to kind of bring it up to 60. It feels like the right format. To be honest, the big thing of it is kind of like I grew up reading a lot of kind of European comics. Like, you know, just like kind of like stuff like Asterix and Lucky Luke and stuff like that. And those books, they're large format. They're a lot denser, but they tend to run about 60 pages in total. It just feels like the optimum length for like a good solid story to me.
No, yeah, I totally agree. So along with La Mariposa, is there, where did the wrestling bug get you? Like, were you like a lifelong wrestling fan, or is it just kind of something you've come into? Because I know a lot of comic artists who like, they were down with wrestling from day one, and they continued that love. And I know some who have like just got into it in the past couple of years because there's kind of a new explosion of it happening. So where did you fall on that? Was wrestling just always prevalent in your life, or is it something you kind of came into later on?
So like, I don't know when I first got into it, because like I was into wrestling when I was a tiny baby boy, like back in like the halcyon days of kind of like Hulk Hogan and, you know, my childhood favorite Bret Hart, Shawn Michaels, all that kind of lot back in the day, like back in that weird sort of day where like kayfabe was still intact.
Yeah.
And the majority of wrestlers were like characters. Mm-hmm. So like you'd be like, oh, this guy's a wrestler, but he also has like a job, but he's just like an insane, like roided out version of this job. So it'd be like, oh, this guy's coming to the ring and he's an actual legit police officer, wink.
Yeah.
Or like, you know, and then they got increasingly insane where you had like a dude who was like a tax collector. You know, it's just like, oh, he's a wrestling tax collector, and he's just this jacked dude in like a shirt and in like a tie and like a dress shirt with no sleeves. So that was the kind of thing that captivated me, and then I kind of fell off it for a while. So like I missed most of the Attitude Era, and then like I completely missed, like I missed like all of like CM Punk and like Bryan Danielson's, you know, rise to stardom. I heard about them, like, because they, you know, there's such huge crossover between kind of like comics and wrestling that you're inevitably going to hear about like CM Punk, you're going to hear about like Bryan Danielson. And then, when kind of like wrestling started to make this kind of resurgence into like popular culture, a few years ago, and like loads of people that I really like were talking about it. They were talking about like, I think what it was is there was a writer that I really like, and he was talking about a SummerSlam, I think in like 2014, where John Cena got like suplexed like 16 times by Brock Lesnar. And he wrote like a really heartfelt kind of like think piece about it, about how, because for him it felt like the death of Superman, because he just watched this dude who was like wrestling Superman just get like mullered. Just get absolutely like suplexed into like paste. I like it. It affected him. I was like, okay, well, I need to go watch. So I went to watch SummerSlam. And the first thing I saw when I flicked it on was the entrance of Bray Wyatt.
Okay.
So Bray Wyatt, for those of you who don't know, he's like, he's not kind of, I don't know if he's retired at the moment or like if he's taking a bit of a break. But when I got back into wrestling, he was doing this weird like, not kind of Cajun cult leader thing. Apparently he was inspired by the guy from Cape Fear, from Robert De Niro's character in Cape Fear.
Okay.
But he was this dude, and he would come in with, like, and he's like this big barrel chested dude with a long ass beard. And he'd come in kind of like a Hawaiian shirt, you know, and kind of like a trilby, which makes him sound like an incel, but that's not the kind of the vibe at all. And he'd be there with a gas lamp, and all the lights would come off, you know, and everyone would switch their mobile phone torches on, and they were like his fireflies. And the idea is that he was like this weird swamp cult leader, and he was backed by these two dudes called the Wyatt families, just kind of had like a Charles Manson vibe kind of thing.
Okay.
Who were like wearing like sheep masks. And he would just, when he got in the ring, he would just do really weird kind of contorted, creepy moves. And he's like a big dude. He's like, he got a, had a bit of a belly on him at the time, and a big old kind of like, he had like a powerlifter's physique. And he'd do things where he'd like drop into like a bridge and kind of like spider walk after people. And he had this move called like the Sister Abigail. And I'd be like, well, who's Sister Abigail? Why she got a move named after her? And like, I was like, oh my God, this is like actual storytelling beyond kind of like what I had come to kind of dismiss wrestling as, which was kind of like class-based warfare. And like Stone Cold Steve Austin doesn't like Vince McMahon because Stone Cold Steve Austin is like a working class dude and McMahon's the boss. And like, it has that weird sort of like, also that weird sort of like dodgier aspect that you get a lot with American wrestling, where like the bad guys are bad guys because they're foreign.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know? And those two factors were so dominant when I kind of fell off of wrestling. That was kind of like, well, this is just like real life. Where's the fantasy gone? And then I saw Bray Wyatt, and then I was just like locked in. So I started to like watch WWE again. I got really into NXT. Started checking out New Japan. And then I've just been kind of like a complete, you know, like mark since then. And then like a couple, like about a year after that, Lucha Underground started, which is, do you ever watch any of that?
No, no. It's, again, it's one of those things where wrestling is definitely one of those things where it's like everyone, like almost everyone I know is into it at some level. So I have like a absorbed knowledge of a lot of these things. And like when you said Bray Wyatt, I'm like, I knew exactly who you were talking about. Like, I wouldn't have been able to like go into detail like you did, but I knew the guy, the image of the guy and all that was in my head just because of people talking about it. So Lucha Underground is definitely one of those things that people were raving about that I have not gotten to yet though.
Sure. Fair enough. Lucha Underground, just for the uninitiated, it was a hour long TV show. And it was like a wrestling show. What was really cool about it is that they basically applied television style directing and kind of production values to a typical wrestling show. So if you watch any kind of given wrestling show, there's inevitably like a backstage scene between matches where like wrestlers, they do it like an interview. And then like another wrestler comes in and is like, oh, I don't like your face. And then they agree to fight next week, or like, you know, there's like an assault backstage and stuff like that. And it's kind of like shot on a handheld, all that kind of stuff. Lucha Underground would do these scenes, but they would shoot them like a Robert Rodriguez movie. I think Robert Rodriguez was like an executive producer on the show. And it would just be like full grindhouse, like cinematically shot, kind of scripted in a very kind of like telenovela style. But what was cool about it is that it was like fully dramatized. It was full kayfabe, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it had like a really in-depth, like magical lore behind it. So I often describe it as basically being if WWE met Mortal Kombat.
Oh, okay.
So like their main protagonist was this dude called Prince Puma. Prince Puma is the descendant of like a long line of Aztec warriors, of the Puma tribe. Because there were like seven tribes. And they all, for some reason, fight in this warehouse in Boyle Heights. And like, there was like a wrestler who was basically Kraven the Hunter, who would like hunt the deadliest game, which is like luchadors. There was a guy called Drago who was like an actual, you were meant to think he's like an actual literal dragon who takes human form. There was like literally scenes where there would be like a fight with a dude. And then Drago would like walk off stage for a dramatic scene and he'd walk off camera and then you'd have like a really kind of dodgy CGI silhouette of a dragon taking off in flight. And he then meets a time traveler and becomes best friends with him via a shared love of nunchucks. They had a character who embodied life, and another character who embodied death, and they had like one of the best wrestling matches of all time, where every time the wrestler who embodied life fell out of the ring, he would just get just beaten half to death. And then as soon as he got back into the ring, as soon as he was able to get back into the ring, he would just recharge because the ring represents life.
Okay. Yeah. this sounds really interesting. I should go seek this out and check this out because it sounds pretty damn entertaining for sure.
The first two seasons are just like some of my unironic favorite instances of television. It's a must watch for anyone who kind of likes the more sort of pulpy, grindhouse, unapologetic kind of like kitsch aspects of wrestling.
Awesome. So, thank you for the very, very detailed trip down your love of wrestling. I think between you, Lan Pitts, Joe Hunter, and speaking to Danny Warren Johnson and so many other of my friends, like, I'm going to have to get into this, I think. I kind of need to have a join into the party, join into the fun. I'm curious about your process for La Mariposa. Like, what's the storytelling process for you, the creation process? Do you kind of work off of a script? Do you kind of have like a general plot and you kind of like figure it out in the layouts? And, you know, after that, like, do you work digitally? Do you work traditionally? Do you have a preference for how you get things done?
So the initial process takes the longest, which is basically just like percolating the idea. Usually what will happen is I will get an idea that I kind of want to build the story around. And that will kind of sit in like a Google Doc while I kind of think on it for a while. Mm-hmm. And then eventually over time, I will sort of like try and spell out the art from kind of how it starts and how to how it ends. Okay. And then from there, I will insert scenes and start to kind of like join up the individual aspects until eventually I have like, you know, a fairly typical kind of rise and fall kind of story arc. And then I'll expand that out into a treatment, which is just like everything that happens in the story start to finish. Not thinking about dialogue or anything like that, just thinking about like this happens, then this happens, then this happens, because this happens, and then this happens, and then this happens. The end. Mm-hmm. And then from that, I will build it up into a full script, which is kind of like just breaking down. I don't really break down individual panels because I find that kind of like restricts my ability to thumbnail in an interesting way.
Okay.
But I break down what happens on each page and I figure out the dialogue on there. And then from there, I go to thumbnailing, which I still do traditionally in a book. Because I just find it easier just to have it at a glance as opposed to like having to, you know, go on like my iPad, or whatever. Like it's not an efficient way of working. Like thumbnailing on an iPad is much, much easier, but I just kind of prefer doing it traditionally for the books for some reason.
You know, I feel the same way. Yeah. I feel the same way. Like, I think thumbnailing traditionally, it's easier than on the iPad. It's just, I don't know, something about it. It's just, I haven't cracked that code with that. So I feel you there.
Sure. I think it depends on your setup because, like, my friend Mark does all his work digitally now, and his thumbnailing process makes perfect sense because he's got it set up in such a way. He does it all the stuff in like Touch Studio Paint.
Yeah.
So all he has to do is So that's set up so he can see all his thumbnails all at once spread out on the screen. And I could do that, but like, I kind of just like have, I have like a shonky little sketchbook full of thumbnails, and like, I lay it out like, you know, eight pages per spread of the sketchbook. So I can see eight pages all at once, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
And then from there, I still draw my comic pages traditionally just because that's part of the aesthetic for me. That's part of the feel of being a comic artist is kind of like ruling out a page on paper. And then just kind of sitting at your desk and just kind of drawing on it with pencil.
Mm-hmm.
I have done like comics like digitally,
yeah,
which is fun, is nice, and is again a lot easier and more efficient. So like if I ever like on the rare occasion that I like take on kind of like for hire comics work, I will more often than not do that all digitally now because it's just easier to tweak and it's easier to make revisions and stuff like that. For my own work, I just like having the originals. I have like five of them pinned up above my desk at the moment. it's just really nice just to be able to look up and just see it all at a glance as opposed to actually having to like go through the process of kind of like opening up stuff on kind of like Procreate.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's interesting because, yeah, I'm definitely, for now, I'm, at least with sequentials, I'm definitely all digital. And when I was laying out, most of the stuff I've been doing lately is shorter stories, right? So it's like, you know, 5, 6, 8 pages. Doing thumbnails like that digitally works fine for me. But when I was doing a whole 20-page book, for some reason, I just needed to do it traditionally. I needed to have like that spread of pages that I can look at. Like, I know Clip Studio can do that if you have the right version or whatever. You can kind of explode it out and see all the pages. But one, I don't have that version. And two, that for some reason, like, my brain was able to move faster when I was doing it traditionally because I had drawn traditionally for so long and working digitally is only the past couple of years have been like full on digital work thanks to the iPad. But so it's there's still that pull for me sometimes to just do all traditional and all that and to deal with the scanning and the cleanup and the of all the fun stuff like that. But I find that just efficiency's sake, I go with the digital. Now, with your art, are there specific influences that you feel you have absorbed the most through? Because
sorry, go on.
No, because looking through the book and all that, you could see, you know, it's I admittedly may not have the same draw from the same like depth of that type of illustrative style as you might. So, but for me, it looks like it just looks like your art. So I can't usually with someone, I think, oh, well, okay, they like Stuart Immonen a lot. They like, you know, and not in a bad thing, just because we all have our influences where we have that visual language begin and stem from. So, but for me and your style, like I have a, I don't have the depth of knowledge of those types of illustrators. So I was curious to see who your main influences were. This is my long roundabout way of saying who's your main influences.
yeah, no worries. So like, it's kind of a weird one. It's like a priority for me early on, as it is for like, I think a lot of like, you know, artists who are like young nowadays is, was finding a style that I could call my own. Yeah. I really wanted to find I wanted people to be able to like see a drawing by me and be like, oh, that's James Lawrence, you know, there's no mistake in it kind of thing. So like for me, finding a solid visual vocabulary, like my way of drawing anything, is always like a priority. And that's kind of like, so initially that during my development, I kind of like, I didn't kind of do the sort of the foundational stuff that I should have done. that does go on to build a style. So I focus too much on kind of the aesthetic and not enough on structure. And so since then, it's been a lot of kind of course correction of kind of like applying those fundamentals, but trying to find a way to do it kind of like creatively and abstract it. So that's my little caveat before I go on to kind of like full scut, kind of like style discussion. But that was kind of like the priority going on. But like anything else, I'm like a product of my own. I am a product of my influences. So like I'm a huge Hellboy fan, a huge Mike Mignola fan, which is kind of like night and day to like my style of drawing stuff. But just the way he kind of like frames and the way that he abstracts kind of like stuff and kind of shows stuff without showing you stuff.
Yeah.
Is a huge, huge deal for me. He's kind of like his sort of minimalist approach, particularly in kind of like his more recent work. I'm a gigantic Usagi Yojimbo fan.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I love Usagi Yojimbo so much. That's like definitely a major influence on the series. Who else? Like, what got me into making my own comics back in the day was like the early 2000s Oni Press boom.
Okay.
Where they were just knocking out just insane original graphic novels. And each one of them was like completely unique and had like the hand of the artist very obvious, very apparent in them. So I'm talking like, you know, Corey Lewis with Sharp Knife, James Stokoe, who's like now, you know, like doing like loads of really cool work for like Marvel and DC. I think his most recent creator own thing is Orphan and the Five Beasts. But like when I was reading, when I first discovered him, he was doing like a graphic novel series called Wonton Soup. Mm-hmm. Which is just like so unique and it's so like innately him. And it was those dudes that I kind of like, those folks that I kind of like really was drawn to, because just like, I see this person's work and there is no way it can be mistaken for anyone else's. You know, it's not like a house style.
Yeah.
Or anything like that. And that's kind of what I gravitated to. It's just like, how does this dude draw cars? How does this lady draw kind of like coffee cups? You know, what makes her coffee cups like distinct from any other coffee cup? Oh, it's because she's applied this kind of like shape language and design to it. So how can I do that for me? That kind of thing.
Awesome.
And then I just read like a lot. Like I read very widely. Like I've got a huge like manga influence as well. So like I love One Piece. You know, I, you know, just read a lot of manga on a weekly basis, which definitely informs my approach to like action a lot of the time.
Yeah, definitely. I definitely see that. I don't have the huge, depth of knowledge with manga and all that. As I've said on the show many, many, many times, it's definitely something I need to get into, because so many people's art that I enjoy pulls from that, and it's like, well, I can definitely learn something here. And you kind of touched on something in the beginning where you're mentioning you were drawn to kind of figuring out the style before the substance, so to speak, or before the foundation. And I completely relate to that. I was definitely someone who did that first. And as I'm going over, I'm doing a thing where I'm going over my first graphic novel. It's rife with that, where like if I had just nailed the structure first, the results would have been 10 times better than they were. And now it's definitely something that I focus on way more now, for sure, than before. And almost to the point to where I'm just like debating, just abandoning all sense of like flourish and trying to see, I there's a couple projects I have in my brain, the short stories, that I'm like, how clean can I get my lines, you know, how clean, like how straightforward can I be with everything? And so yeah, I totally sympathize with you there and all that.
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, like I wish, because I'm like self-taught as an artist. I didn't like, I don't have like a formal art education. I'm kind of like, I mean, self-taught's kind of like an iffy term, because everyone kind of learns from someone. It's just a question of whether or not that learning is kind of like directly given, or whether or not it's like absorbed independently. But that's neither here nor there. But like, if I had, you know, the structure to kind of like learn the fundamentals before I got, you know, I mean, you put it really perfectly. Like, if I learned the substance before I learned the style, I would be so much faster than I am now, because I am still, you know, at this stage of the game, having to solve a lot of problems, like on my pages, because the, that fundamental kind of like training hasn't quite caught up to where I'm at in terms of my ambitions.
Yeah.
So like, I still really struggle with perspective, for example. I have to like, you know, a lot of kind of, you know, I'm fine with gesture. I'm fine with characters. I'm making myself do more and more kind of like full backgrounds and environments. But like, you know, if you ask me to draw a realistic city street, I will just burst into tears. because like, that's just, you know, long straight linear lines that are clearly receding towards a vanishing point. That's like one of my real weak points. which is, again, is another thing where kind of like with the Legend of La Mariposa, is like all the buildings are kind of like deliberately wonky, and part of that is the aesthetic, and part of that is just like, you know, me just kind of like doing linear perspective and trying my best, and then eventually just giving up.
Well, it worked.
Kind of like, you know what, this is good enough.
It doesn't come across that way. It everything looks deliberate, intentional. It fits within the style of the world and what you're doing. So, yeah, I wouldn't say by any means it comes across that way.
Ah, thank you very much. That means for the sure. Con is working.
No, but when you said like you got to draw a city street and just like, even for myself, like I wouldn't know how to like correctly define my style. Like, I don't think I'm overly realistic, but I don't necessarily think I'm like, I'm definitely not like over exaggerated or anything like that. So I'm definitely, I kind of try to shy away from like trying to figure out what's my style like, because I spent so long dicking around with that and not getting it. That, you know, I'm like, just cares. Who cares what my style is? Just draw.
Your style, based on kind of the artwork that I've seen on Twitter, it does kind of remind me of kind of like some of the later, like sort of Tank Girl era, sort of Jamie Hewlett, where it's kind of like, you know, it's kind of proportionally accurate and representational, but there is enough kind of abstraction there that it kind of like doesn't read like sort of like more sort of like formalist art, if that makes sense.
I will take that gladly. There's definitely, you know, times where I want to be more abstract. I want to be more exaggerated with things, and you know, I it's definitely styles I want to play with and all that. But yeah, just, you know, for myself, the past couple of years has been just finding what I just do naturally, and not trying to force an idea upon what it is I draw. So like, just draw how my brain is going to process and draw that, and then trying to kind of accept that, like, that's how my brain draws, and then get good at that, and then take in the influences, and then to see how that grows and changes. And that's kind of been my journey with that. Cause like you, I'm self-taught too. You know, I've got, you know, no real formal training or anything like that at all. And so I definitely, have had those conversations myself, and you know, I appreciate your description of my style and all that. And, I will definitely, take that as a compliment, because that's, you know, I really enjoy Jamie Hewlett's stuff and all that. So I'll have to see it and like see if my brain can find those comparisons in there. But yeah,
I mean, the abstraction stuff is I think that's kind of a tricky thing that a lot of people focus on kind of like getting things right when they draw.
yeah.
composition, which, you know, I think is important to a degree. But like, if you're seeking abstraction, a lot of the time it's about allowing yourself to kind of like get away from that idea and get things willfully wrong, you know? So like, for example, drawing a car, you know, if you're drawing a car, you need to make sure, and if you want this car to be a realistic functional car, you have to make sure that kind of like the proportions are correct.
Yeah.
That, for example, it has enough clearance between the wheels and kind of the bottom of the body of the vehicle. Otherwise, it's going to like scrape all over the road, right?
Yeah.
If you're trying to abstract it, you have to kind of train yourself out of thinking that matters.
Yeah.
And like the thing I think about with my characters is I don't think of my characters as having skeletons. I always describe them as being rubber people.
Okay.
And that thought alone helps me get away from getting hung up on like, you know, accurate, consistent proportions. And it helps me be much more sort of exaggerated with kind of like foreshortening and kind of gesture.
Yep.
Especially when I'm drawing like characters like in different wrestling holds, you know?
Yeah.
Because my characters are all different shapes and sizes. It wouldn't be fun. You know, La Mariposa's like head is so big that there are some things that just like proportionally accurate she just wouldn't be able to do. So I have to like cheat the length of the arms. I like have her neck be longer in some panels than it is in others. Otherwise, she'll just look like a weirdo. Like the character wouldn't really necessarily work if I modeled her in 3D.
Mm-hmm.
Like I'd have to make adjustments. But on the 2D comic page, it doesn't matter.
Yeah, for sure, for sure. Well, you know, again, just looking at what you sent me and the stuff you have, like it doesn't feel that way. So you've gotten like excellent at like just having it all merge and feel natural within the flow of the story and the action. So, you know, kudos to you, because that is definitely something that I know a lot of people try to shoot for, is just having that, like, you know, not having to be so slavish to proper proportions and things like that, but still have things feel and look right and not be distracting and look wrong. Like that's the thing I come across a lot for myself, where I tend to give art I enjoy the benefit of the doubt. Like if something is not perfect, so to speak, like I use guitars a lot as a reference for this. It's like if someone draws a guitar and it's a little bit funky looking, like it's not the exact shape of the guitar that they're doing, whatever, or the frets look a little weird or whatever. Like I'm usually like, okay, whatever. That's how they draw the guitar. But if I'm drawing the guitar,
still recognize that it's a guitar.
Yeah, if I'm drawing the guitar, it's like this shit better be fucking perfect, or it's just gonna look like trash to me. I'm getting better with that. I'm getting allowing myself to have a little more leeway with that, because, you know, it's not healthy. But
I think one of the most important things, like you make a really good point, that I think one of the most important things that an artist can do is forgive themselves for the same things that they forgive other artists for.
Yeah.
You know, because we are always way harder on ourselves than we are on other people.
Yeah. And the funny thing is, like, some of these things that I would hate to see in my own art are what I love about other artists, you know? And yeah, it's just like,
exactly.
You know, one, brain, you suck for doing that. But two, like how do I get to that? And, you know, first off, acknowledging it is big, but, you know, it's definitely one of those things that it's an almost constant thought with things, because there's artists I enjoy whose art is very loose and very free form with, you know, anatomy and stuff like that. And there's other artists who I enjoy who like, they are like spot on, you know, realistic. And like, there's a artist, Mark Laming. He is just phenomenal. Like he's just, but his stuff is very grounded in realistic proportions and things like that. But I can enjoy his stuff just as much as I would enjoy someone like Kate Sharon or Liana Kangas, or even like going like John Romita Jr., where all his dudes are just giant block men, you know, like.
And all his kids look like just scaled down adults.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, it's, but it's, you know, to me, it's like, oh, that's perfect. But, yeah, so yeah, it's just finding that forgiveness of yourself. And I guess it's just it kind of goes back to the not back to, but because we didn't really mention it, but it goes to the thing of like being able to objectively look at your own stuff, you know, and not see the mistakes, but see, you know, the thing as a whole. And that's just something I think we all struggle with, and we all do our best to try to get over, but it's
yeah, it's tricky. It's kind of like you need to strike that balance, because if you look at everything that you do and be like, that's perfect, that's amazing, I'm a god, then that can really stunt your development.
Mm-hmm.
You need that dissatisfaction to kind of keep you improving. But you also need to just not, like, beat yourself up. Like, you know, I always say, like, I will redraw things if they are really not working on a comics page.
Yeah.
But more often than not, stuff that I didn't do in one comic that I wish I'd done goes into the next comic.
Yeah.
So volume 3, you know, in Vulcan's Challenge, I probably shouldn't be like talking it down because I'm trying to fund it. But I feel like I skimped on backgrounds a lot. And like, you know, I mean, I kind of made that problem for myself because I set the majority of the story in like a desert, in like a wrestling ring in the middle of a desert, in like an amphitheater. So one of the things that I'm doing for volume 4 that I'm working on at the moment is, the setting is really important because it's kind of like a seminal location for like La Mariposa. It's kind of like the town where she grew up.
Okay.
So like every page has got like full backgrounds unless there's like an action scene where the background needs to be subsumed to make room for the action, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And it's taking me much longer per page, but I'm so much more satisfied with it. And I could have gone back and just made myself fill in the background of Vulcan's Challenge and kind of like redraw pages that I felt that I now feel are like maybe a little sparser than I would like. But if I did that, I would probably still be working on it now.
Yeah.
And I gotta get these books out, you know?
Was it perfect as the enemy of finished? Is that what the saying goes?
Yeah, I think that's a good way to put it.
And you know, and I'm sure you mentioned that, but I'm sure like so much of that is just your point of view of it, and people reading it would be like, what are you talking about? This is fine. Like, it's in a desert. We get it.
That's
boom.
That's always
done.
The case. That's yeah. Always the case. Like, no one ultimately, the other great fact as well, and it's kind of like, is the average person spends maybe like under a minute reading a page of any given comic.
Yeah.
You know? I think it's something like an average of like 4 seconds per panel, you know? If you realize that, then all of a sudden you don't need to worry
yeah.
a lot.
Exactly.
Because you also have to remember the pace that people read things at.
Mm-hmm.
You know? You've not drawn a full background on this page. That's fine because it's not about the background. It's about the characters having a conversation.
Yeah.
And that's what the audience is going to be interested in.
Yeah, for sure. 100%. And that's definitely something that I've tried to take with me as, you know, the book I'm drawing right now is, there's a lot of crowd scenes. Because it's about a rock and roll band. And so I'm trying to find the right balance of giving the idea of there's a lot of people and not feeling like I have to draw every single distinct person. And it's definitely a learning curve. I'm figuring it out as I go. And you know, as these things go, that's definitely a lot is done in the layouts and almost kind of like your decision to make this story in the desert. You know, I can say, oh, well, this is, you know, the lights are off in the club, you know, and it's a bit more shadowy and things like that. And, or, you know, just more silhouettes, just do more silhouettes and then things like that. But yeah, it's, I understand where you're coming from because you don't ever want to feel like you're skimping out, but you also feel like I'd rather get this book done than feel like, oh, because I didn't draw the specific building or whatever, it's a lesser book somehow, and because that's just not true. And you know, I think it's better to have an imperfect completed thing than a perfectly finished thing that no one's ever going to see, because then what was the work for if you're still working on it years and years later and all that? So
exactly 100%.
So as people may not be fully aware, we're doing this at kind of some off times for both of us to try to match up time zones. So I don't want to keep you on too much longer. So can you talk about the upcoming Kickstarter? This episode will be dropping on, let me get the exact date here, the 1st of July. So let everybody know.
Amazing.
When your next Kickstarter is dropping, what they can expect, and if there's any other pertinent information you feel they need to know.
Sure. So 1st of July is a great time for this episode to drop, because that is launch day.
Oh, fantastic.
For the latest Legend of La Mariposa Kickstarter. We will be funding the third volume, which is called Vulcan's Challenge. It's a 60-page graphic novella. It's a self-contained adventure. As I've always said, is like, you don't have to be a wrestling fan to enjoy The Legend of La Mariposa, because at the end of the day, it's a goofy action adventure. And, I even label the wrestling moves, on the page. So don't feel like you'll be left in the cold if you're not super into wrestling. I think there's something there for everyone. I will be offering as an add-on the first two books. I design every La Mariposa volume to be standalone, but if you are a completist, you'll be able to get all three books as part of the Kickstarter. The first volume, The Demon Gauntlet, is very low in stock, so I'm offering up the remaining copies as an add-on. I don't know when I'm going to do a reprint, because that was a Kickstarter as well, so don't sleep on that if you're kind of missing that volume. And I will also be offering the usual raft of goodies that people like. So I'll be offering like a sticker sheet, a couple of sets of postcard prints, and the latest Graps patch, which is a series of kind of like iron-on patches that I do that are wrestling-themed, but usually tend to be adopted by people for like sort of different meanings.
Okay.
As well.
Cool.
We're looking to make £2,200, which I think breaks down to maybe about $3,000 American. I think it's very achievable. I'm really excited. I'm really looking forward to sharing this book with everyone.
Awesome. And I can attest to, you sent me the second volume, last year. Let me get the title here. The Climb and Other Stories. And, you know, like I said, even though I have some wrestling knowledge and all that through, you know, absorbing my friends talking about it, I really don't know. And it is so not necessary to be a wrestling fan. You just need to be a fan of like fun action comics and, like you said, slapstick comedy and things like that. If you're a fan of that kind of stuff, this book is for you. Like, you know, the art's fantastic. The coloring's fantastic too. I failed to mention that earlier. And it's a great looking book, hilarious. There's in the second volume, there's a gag with a gentleman in a white suit in the beginning of the book, and I keep coming back to that because it just makes me laugh. The reference of it just makes me laugh so much. It's so perfect. There's also I don't want to give away too much, but there's a wrestling kick move called Scorpion Sunday.
Oh yeah, the super kick Sunday.
Super kick. Oh, I'm sorry. I thought it was Scorpion. Sorry, my super kick Sunday.
No, that's all right. And that's actually a better name.
Well, feel free to take it. Super kick Sunday, and that was just, you know, a big laugh moment when that popped up. So definitely check this out. There's going to be a link in the show notes for you to go and back the book. Check them out. Get all the volumes. Will they be offered digitally as well?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I always offer a digital tier because international shipping is such...
Yeah.
It's not great.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a great situation, international shipping. I treasure every international backer who's willing to, like, plump for international shipping. I super appreciate it, but I also understand that not everyone is that flush, so I always offer digital versions for people.
Awesome.
Who just can't afford, like, the, you know, either can't afford or don't want to pay out for international shipping. So yes, digital available for all three books.
Awesome, awesome. And as someone who likes to read, you know, actual physical media, but I also like the convenience of digital, and also the idea of that, you know, buying the digital version, it gives you money, and it's the least amount of work you got to do. I feel good about that. So I will definitely be part of the digital tiers. Again, everyone, go check this out. The Legend of La Mariposa. It's just super fun comics. And as you've heard, James is an awesome dude. Thank you so much for taking the time to come on. And I definitely will have you back. Hopefully by time.
Oh, thank you.
At this rate, you know, we can make it a yearly thing. Every time a new volume comes out, boom. As long as I'm doing this. Let's get you on here. Let's chat.
All right.
And then, you know, let me know what you're thinking of, what you think of the recommendations you sent me for music, and I will do the same.
Hell yeah. Absolutely, man. Thank you. It's been a real pleasure. Thanks for having me on board.
It's been a blast, sir. You have a good rest of your day.
Yeah, you too, man. You too.
All right, man. Thank you so much.
Yeah, cheers, bud.
Thank you for listening to the Comics Coffee Metal Podcast. Please be sure to join me next episode with my guest, writer Erica Schultz. See you then.